This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, August 7th, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. There is a cliffhanger developing on Capitol Hill. The nuclear deal negotiated with Iran may have suffered a significant setback. While Republican presidential candidates were out railing against the president at a surprisingly highly rated debate last night that we'll talk about in just a moment, President Obama was taking the biggest hit from a member of his own party. Influential Democratic Senator Charles Schumer of New York says he will vote against the Iran nuclear agreement when Congress takes up a disapproval measure later this month. Can Schumer lure enough Democrats to join him to overcome a White House veto the president has promised if Congress votes against the Iran deal? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Can this Schumer end up turning the Iran deal into a train wreck?
It's certainly a risk for the White House, and this was definitely a setback. It's important to point out right off the top that in addition to saying that he will vote to disapprove, a Schumer aide told me afterward that he would also vote to override. You got to differentiate between those two things because some members of Congress already have been parsing those two votes. I might vote against the deal, but I wouldn't vote to override and undermine the president. Schumer is not in that camp. John, look, Chuck Schumer's vote was being very closely watched here. He's the leading pro-Israel voice in Congress, Jewish Democratic senator from New York. He's also the next Democratic leader of the Senate. At the same time, he's vehemently pro-Obama and has stood to back them up in messaging and votes for years. So that's why everybody was watching his vote closely.
Is it possible that Schumer is counting the votes and that he sort of figures that there's not going to be an override vote here, that even if he votes with the overriders, that his sort of vote of conscience is safe here and that the president will still get his nuclear deal and that Schumer can look forward to other things that he might aspire to, like being governor of New York?
Of course it's possible. I mean, every senator and every leading senator counts votes often before they publicly decide what they're going to do, and those outcomes are important. It's very possible that Chuck Schumer knows that or thinks that, but again, half of Democrats haven't publicly declared their positions. Last night when this news came out during the Republican debate, liberals and some former White House aides reacted strongly and bitterly against Chuck Schumer. MoveOn.org, a powerful liberal fundraiser, said cut off fundraising to Chuck Schumer. People like Jon Favreau, Barack Obama's former speechwriter, Dan Pfeiffer, former White House communications director, took to Twitter attacking Schumer and said he can't be Democratic leader of the Senate when he undermines the Democratic president in this way. Whether other Democrats jump on board with this anti-Schumer position, I think remains to be seen. It probably doesn't undermine his chances of being Democratic leader. He's got a great deal of goodwill in that caucus for many, many other reasons.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You got it, John.
What was billed as a forgettable preliminary look at the GOP presidential field turned out to be a possible Emmy contender. It was ratings gold, at least, for Fox News. A lot of Americans tuned in last night to see if Donald Trump could get rattled by tough questions and ganged up on by his fellow debaters. And they were not disappointed.
See, I think you're on the wrong side of this if you're still arguing for a single payer
system. I don't think you heard me. You're having a hard time tonight.
All right, let's...
There's Donald Trump hammering the hearing-impaired Rand Paul. And here is Jeb Bush, the centrist hopeful, attacking the man with the most name recognition on stage in Cleveland. It seemed last night as though Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida's mission, was to leave Cleveland as the most credible of the non-Trumps.
Mr. Trump's language is divisive. I want to win. I want one of these people here, or the ones at 5 o'clock, to be the next president of the United States. We're not going to win by doing what Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton do each and every day, dividing the country, saying, creating a grievance kind of environment. We're going to win when we unite people with a hopeful, optimistic message.
But all these candidates were bucking the hopeful, optimistic numbers in the U.S. economy recently. 215,000 jobs were created in July, according to the Labor Department. Here's Florida Senator Marco Rubio talking about struggling families and one family in particular.
If I'm our nominee, how is Hillary Clinton going to lecture me about living paycheck to paycheck? I was raised paycheck to paycheck. How is she going to lecture me about student loans? I owed over $100,000 just 4 years ago. If I'm our nominee, we will be the party of the future.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker tried to sell his foreign policy creds.
This is not just bad with Iran. This is bad with ISIS. It is tied together. And once and for all, we need a leader who's going to stand up and do something about it. It's yet another example of the failed foreign policy of the Obama-Clinton doctrine.
Foreign policy was also what Senator Ted Cruz was selling.
and we need a commander-in-chief that speaks the truth. We will not defeat radical Islamic terrorism so long as we have a president unwilling to utter the words radical Islamic terrorism.
Dr. Ben Carson, the only African-American, had perhaps the best line of the night, a comment on his personal resume and a commentary on Washington, D.C. culture.
I'm the only one to separate Siamese twins. The only one to operate on babies while they were still in the mother's womb. The only one to take out half of a brain, although you would think if you go to Washington that someone had beat me to it. But...
Not bad, Dr. Carson. Among the entertaining tweets during the proceeding came from someone who might have wished he was back here. Former candidate Herman Cain tweeted, blah, blah, blah. The big question last night, though, was whether Ohio can be in the GOP column in 2016, and that was hard to know from last night's proceedings. But someone who might know, and joining us, is Matt Borges, chairman of the Ohio Republican Party. Matt, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So now, I was born in Dayton, Ohio, and I've spent a lot of time in Ohio, and I have to think that a lot of Ohioans looking at that candidate forum and then the debate last night might be thinking, boy, we need to narrow this down pretty quickly. This spectacle isn't good for the party. What do you think?
I think the exact opposite. I think we had the first opportunity to take a look at all of our candidates last night, hear their vision, and broadcast that to a live national audience of millions of people. And it's about which vision for the future, I think, is going to lead us back in the right direction.
What do you make of your favorite son, Governor Kasich? He did pretty well, the latest to announce his candidacy, and he had some lively success at the debate, it seemed.
I don't think there's any question about that. He was warmly received by the crowd. He's doing well in polls in New Hampshire. He's up to second place there already. I thought he had a couple of the lines of the night.
The court has ruled, and I said we'll accept it. And guess what? I just went to a wedding of a friend of mine who happens to be gay. Because somebody doesn't think the way I do doesn't mean that I can't care about them or I can't love them. So if one of my daughters happened to be that, of course I would love them and I would accept them.
You know, Republicans care so much about families, and what his answer about how he would stand by his family members, I thought, to me, was such a special and important moment. You know, Governor Kasich's got a great record. He's the only candidate on the stage or who balanced the federal budget, done it at the national and state level, has national security experience also, and he's distinguishing himself just by talking about his record. You look at that group and you can see a handful of folks who you know probably aren't going to be back here in Cleveland a year from now.
Such as?
Probably the guy standing in the middle. I have been through these many, many times, and you know that our party is going to eventually coalesce around a candidate who is prepared and qualified to go through the rigors of a year-long test of what the media and what the public and what the Democrats are going to put us all through. But there are also some that you can envision really picking up that mantle and being able to survive that. And one of those folks, without any question in my mind, would be John Kasich.
What about Jeb Bush?
I think Jeb has a compelling message and could be a good candidate as well. But we'll see kind of how he emerges from the field as well.
He seemed a little unprepared last night, kind of not exactly polished.
You know, I think sometimes in those forums, it's a little bit difficult to get everything across that you want to say. I looked at a breakdown of the 2 hours. Each of the candidates only had about 8 or 9 minutes of talking time apiece. And so there'll be other opportunities down the road. And so we'll see how it all goes on into the future. And I'll tell you from the Ohio Republican Party standpoint that listening to the very first answer, when you had one candidate saying that they wouldn't support the eventual nominee.
You're standing on a Republican primary.
I fully understand.
The place where the RNC will give the nominee the nod.
I fully understand.
And that experts say an independent run would almost certainly hand the race over to Democrats and likely another Clinton. You can't say tonight that you can make that pledge.
I cannot say. I have to respect the person that, if it's not me, the person that wins. If I do win and I'm leading by quite a bit, that's what I want to do. I can totally make that pledge. If I'm the nominee, I will pledge I will not run as an independent.
That's not going to get him anywhere in terms of getting support from our state party. A total non-starter. This stuff isn't about individuals. This is about the greater good. This is about the party. This is about the country. And while we recognize that none of these folks would be running if they didn't think that they had the right vision.
What do you think about immigration? Trump claims that he invented the issue.
If it weren't for me, you wouldn't even be talking about illegal immigration, Chris. You wouldn't even be talking about it.
I actually kind of found that another amusing thing. I think that we've been talking about immigration now for a couple decades that had nothing to do with any other individual bringing it up. An issue that's got to be resolved, that seriously has had a lot of different folks looking at it. George W. Bush had a proposal that's similar to what a lot of the folks are talking about doing now.
Finally, before we go, was it just me or did Chris Christie and Rand Paul seem a little desperate?
I don't know about desperate. I just think that they certainly didn't appreciate each other in at least one exchange.
I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from innocent Americans. The Fourth Amendment was what we fought the revolution over. John Adams said it was the spark that led to our war for independence. And I'm proud of standing for the Bill of Rights, and I will continue to stand for the Bill of Rights.
And Megan? Megan, that's a completely ridiculous answer. I want to collect more records from terrorists, but less records from other people. How are you supposed to know, Megan?
Use the Fourth Amendment.
How are you supposed
to? Use the Fourth Amendment.
No, I'll tell you how you
get a warrant.
Let me tell you something. You
get a judge to sign
when
a warrant.
You know, Senator.
Go ahead, wait, Governor Christie, make your point.
Listen, Senator. You know, when you're sitting in a subcommittee just blowing hot air about this, you can say things like that. When you're responsible for protecting the lives of the American people, then what you need to do is to make sure that you use the system the way it's supposed to work.
You almost had to wonder when one non-lawyer was lecturing another lawyer on the Constitution, where that was coming from. But look, these things happen in debates. They're sometimes for theater. When candidates' numbers start to backslide, they come out swinging. Look at Hillary Clinton. Her numbers are backsliding now. She is out there with a TV buy to try to change her numbers among her perception with women. And I'm sure that was not something that was planned even just a couple of weeks ago.
Matt Borges, chairman of the Ohio Republican Party, commenting on the debate last night in his state of Ohio. Thanks so much, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
This weekend marks the end of a long, turbulent year for the people of Ferguson, Missouri. Since the killing of Michael Brown, the protests locally and around the nation, the events in Ferguson began a year of soul-searching on issues of criminal justice, police brutality, and race relations in America.
It's an emotional roller coaster for Michael Brown's parents.
We would like the protesters to stop the violence. We certainly don't want to have any violence.
We're just asking people to be peaceful and that we are actively working to resolve this situation.
And they continue to throw tear gas around me to where I could not leave.
Deep in my
As Americans, we've got to use this moment to seek out our shared humanity that's been laid bare by this moment.
We shall overcome someday.
The federal government immediately began to second-guess local politicians and law enforcement officials in Ferguson. There was a shakeup in the Ferguson Police Department, a Justice Department report that made public a culture of racism and intolerance in the Ferguson Police Department. Then U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called for change earlier this year.
Now that our investigation has reached its conclusion, it is time. It is time for Ferguson's leaders to take immediate, wholesale, and structural corrective action.
Officials in Ferguson responded with actions on the ground and in some cases expressed impatience with the federal government's intervention into local matters. In response to the Justice Department's report on Ferguson's law enforcement system, Mayor James Knowles told the New York Times that the Justice Department had created a climate of fear, scaring police from doing their job. Police are scared to pull people over because they're going to be called a racist, the mayor said. It's been a tough year for Mayor James Knowles. Residents who believe the mayor has been too supportive of the police issued a petition for his ouster, but James Knowles is still in office, and he says he's doing his best to bridge the divide between residents, police, and local leaders.
You know, in Ferguson, I think we've seen over the past year, it's become more, especially in the media, than just the city of Ferguson. It's really become a symbol for a number of places, a number of things, and trying to deal with things that are oftentimes outside of the control of me as mayor or even our local city government, it's been very challenging.
Have people had to learn what the limits of mayoral power are in a place like Ferguson over the last year?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's a lot of misconceptions that this is a full-time job. It's not. I have a full-time job. You know, being mayor of Ferguson pays about $300 a month after taxes. You know, so I think many people just assume that, you know, the mayor of Ferguson has executive authority, which I don't. I'm the leader of the council. I preside over the meetings. You know, I sign bills into law, but I can't veto bills, can't give direct direction to city staff members. So, yeah, it's been a learning hurdle for a number of people.
What has changed in the last year, and how much has the city council been involved in those changes?
Well, the city council, as early as last August, really started to take a proactive role into looking at ourselves, what we do as a community, what we do as a city government, what's working, what isn't, engaging residents, especially residents who are crying out to be heard, and finding out how we can deal with the issues that they brought to light. And we started making those reforms as a council through ordinances, through policy changes right away last year. And that's something that we've continued throughout the past year. You know, the city charter does limit what we can do. But at the same time, the city council has focused on, we really walked that line a little bit with the city charter to ensure that these reforms and these policies were put into place to address the issues that have come up since last August.
Has there been a sufficient level of reform in the Ferguson Police Department, in your view?
I think so. I mean, I think they're all in the right direction. Again, to change that's happening in the police department, we started several months ago, 6 months ago, engaged some consultants to help us reorganize the police department in a manner in which would create a more community-oriented policing environment, a more community-oriented policing strategy. We're already seeing a tremendous response from our residents who are saying that they do like what they're seeing. They do like the direction we're seeing. And we'll continue to engage the residents to find out what are the things they would like to see happen, both with our police department and our city government.
Has the Department of Justice's investigation and its findings about law enforcement in Ferguson and some of the very alarming conclusions about the culture of, I guess it's hard to describe, but certainly a culture of intolerance in the police department, has that been helpful? Has that been illuminating for the people of Ferguson? Has it helped to direct the course of change, or has it gotten in the way?
I mean, I think it's cut both ways, I think, for some residents. I think for some residents, it's been very frustrating. You know, when we talk about many of the issues that even the Justice Department talked about, these are things that we've been talking to our residents about since we started engaging the community back in August. And many of the reforms that even the Justice Department suggested, the city of Ferguson was actually already underway with making some of those reforms. So to some extent, it did kind of tear back open a wound, which we were already trying to be in the process of healing. But, you know, we've been focused from day one on, there was about 12 pages at the end discussing which ways we can move forward as a community, what ways we can better orient the police department, be more effective, be more community-oriented, be more fair, help with these divisions in our community. We focused on making those reforms both before that report and after, and we're going to continue to focus on that because ultimately we think we'll have both a better police department, better city services, and a better city after we make those reforms.
Has the recall effort against you toughened you? Has your year in the mayor's office caused self-reflection on your part? And do you leave civic office feeling, man, that was a huge mistake. I'll never do anything like that again.
Well, I'm not leaving office. They didn't recall me. So they tried twice, and you know they may try again. I've served going on 11 years in public service since I was 25 years old as a city councilman and a mayor. I've given a great deal of my time and effort to this community, which I grew up in, lived in 35 years, and not for a moment would I have abdicated that responsibility or that service to someone else. It has been tough on me. It's been a burden that I bear willingly. My family does too. My parents who live in the community, they've been victims of a great deal, both vandalism to their homes and identity theft, as well as myself and my wife. Never once has any member of my family or myself thought about leaving or that this wasn't worth it.
James Knowles, mayor of Ferguson, Missouri, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
I just want to tell you all how happy I am to be back in the studio making a picture again.
It was a bilious piece of dirt that made me cry out in pain.
Did you say it was a brilliant piece of work and you'll fly me out to Spain?
I've seen The Exorcist about 167 times and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it.
They're back in the studio again to talk about pictures and Hollywood. It's Friday. Of course, when we talk about movies, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. They are host and co-host of the Movie Date podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hey, John.
Hi, John.
So number one movie is animal movie, Shaun the Sheep. Which is about the best impression of this film we can give you in radio. Tell us, Rafer.
Well, that's because there's no what you'd call talking in this film, not real dialogue. Remember, the Minions all spoke in kind of a babble. Mm-hmm. This film is even less verbal. It's mostly just sighing and kind of utterances like, and oh. So, but I think it kind of works. It'll obviously work internationally. It's a very cute, very charming movie. I love Aardman animation. I find it a little low-key. I found the mayhem in this film to be a little less explosive than I would have liked. But I think if you're a five-year-old who just wants to see the adventures of a little sheep in the big city having fun and running riot, you'll probably enjoy it.
An extension in the prelingual WALL-E genre, where you don't need English. Minions is number two, and this is number three. What did you think, Kristen?
Yeah, and also I think that if you are a child who likes the TV series, Shaun the Sheep is a TV series also, and if you like Wallace and Gromit, you're going to find all the animation just absolutely adorable. But I have to agree with Rafer. It's best suited to people who are five and possibly people who are like grandparents' age who are going to enjoy this. But all the other age groups, I keep thinking about the Minions and how frenetic and crazy and wacky and loud everything is. This is much calmer. It's very adorable, but not very exciting for those in between ages.
But it wasn't intended for them. So we would say this is a pretty positive review for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be a hit, and I think that show does have a following mostly in England, but it'll be interesting to see if it can get traction here.
A lot of surprises here. Diary of a Teenage Girl, some performances and debuts.
My name is Minnie Getz. I'm recording this onto a cassette tape because my life has gotten really crazy of late. I had sex today. If you're listening to this without my permission, please stop now. Just stop.
I'm gonna kill you!
Great characters in this film and very much a coming-of-age movie for girls. What did you think, Kristen?
Yeah, this is based on a very popular graphic novel of the same name. It centers on a 15-year-old girl who is emerging as a comic book artist herself, who is having her first sexual experiences. And it's really just an unapologetic look at the fact that a 15-year-old girl will want to have sex. It's not the American Pie version where she's just an object of crude jokes. She's going out there. She's trying what she wants to. Sometimes it meanders off in different directions that, you know, slowed the story down. But overall, I thought the film was really enjoyable, really smart, and gives you a lot to think about.
The plot's a bit of a reversal of The Graduate here.
Yeah, that's a good point. She winds up, I don't think this is a spoiler, she winds up sleeping with her mother's boyfriend, the mom, played by Kristen Wiig, who's actually very good, and the boyfriend is Alexander Skarsgård, who is also really great. I like this movie. I like the fact that it's set in San Francisco in the post-hippie era. The city looks great, and I like all the idea of the culture that this girl is in, where free love and experimentation and sort of breaking all the traditional American rules is in. That's what's cool, and that's what's hip. But of course, it winds up getting her in a great deal of trouble. I agree with Kristen. It's cool to see a movie that does for girls what a lot of these movies do for men. They go off and have these sexual misadventures and they grow up and learn something about themselves. I did feel that her behavior at times was a little disturbing. This is not a movie for your average preteen girl, I would say, or anyone younger than preteens. But there's something very interesting and very fresh about the film.
But if you like girls on TV, you would like this film or no?
There's a kinder heart to this than to girls. Yeah. Girls can be a little bit mean-hearted. Yeah. And for that reason, I think it's a kinder, gentler version of teenagehood.
The blockbuster Fantastic Four.
You basically ripped a hole in the fabric of space-time with unspecced components and no supervision.
Yeah, that was an accident.
And if by accident you upped the power, you would have created a runaway reaction that opened a black hole and swallowed the entire planet.
Well, I'm glad that didn't happen.
The first Fantastic Four was an ensemble that really didn't work. How about this one?
This one doesn't work either. Frankly, a lot of long speeches like the one you just heard. And I cannot believe I'm saying this, but there's not enough action in this movie. I think there's just really one action scene in the entire film. The only good thing I can say about this is that it's only about an hour and 40 minutes, and thank goodness for that.
Ooh, bad news.
Yeah, I think this might actually be kind of the anti-blockbuster in terms of superhero movies. This is a Fox movie, not a Disney Marvel movie, and I think that's kind of an important distinction. Disney does this stuff well, and I think the other studios don't do it quite as well. Sony really trashed the Spider-Man series, and I think this is an example of another studio taking a property like this and really wrecking it. The effects are terrible. I think the characters are very weird and grotesque and at worst uninteresting. And I just thought the film was absolutely horrible. I was really surprised.
Let's just say the not quite Fantastic Four from Rafer and Kristen here. What on the podcast this week?
We have our full Joel Edgerton interview talking about The Gift, which is a terrific movie.
And he's a terrific character who's had a lot of interesting experiences as an Australian and growing up in the movies.
Oh, yeah. He's been in a lot of our favorite movies. He's been some of the best characters in movies. We also, Rafer and I were talking earlier about how much we just loved him as Tom in The Great Gatsby. But yeah, he's also been in, you know, Star Wars prequels. He's been in a ton of movies.
Well, it's all Edgerton on the podcast. Kristen Mines, our culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, who's a film critic for Newsday. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, John.
On this day, when the 5.3% unemployment rate stays steady and U.S. employers hired a larger-than-expected 215,000 workers in July, a discussion about CEO pay and what it means for the notion of equity in the U.S. economy. Do CEOs care if you know how much they make? Do CEOs care if their lowest-paid employees know how much they make? Does the person who maintains the edit software over at Discovery Communications, for instance, care that CEO David Zaslav makes $156 million? Do shareholders of that company care? The Securities and Exchange Commission is betting yes that shareholders need to know the ratio of the highest paid employee to the lowest paid staffers. The average is 300-1 today, and not so terribly long ago, in 1965, it was 20-1. 3,800 publicly traded companies will now have to share that pay ratio starting in 2017, according to this SEC rule. Deborah Lifshay is a managing director in the New York office of Perlmeyer & Partners, a firm that specializes in executive compensation consulting.
It's interesting to address the question, do people care to see what the CEO makes? You know, this data has been available for many years now. What's new is trying to track and locate who the median employee is in a corporation that has hundreds of thousands of workers, and then trying to figure out that employee's compensation and then relate it back to the CEO's compensation, two drastically different individuals doing two drastically different jobs.
But does it matter that a company is maybe 400-1 in its ratio of median employee or lowest paid employee to the highest paid employee versus a 20-1, 10-1? Does it bespeak a certain efficiency, equity?
The problem is it's not an apples to apples comparison. Every company will have drastically different ratios because every company has drastically different workforces. Also, the reality is every company can use a different statistical sampling. If you dig down to what this number is actually showing, it's not as meaningful as what the intent was and what the public thinks it will be because of the way that companies are required to gather the information and use the statistics.
Well, how do CEOs decide how much they're going to get paid, or how do companies decide how much to pay their CEOs? Because in many cases, the CEO is on the board and has a little bit of input into how much his or her salary is going to be.
I mean, that's true that they have input, but over the years, there's been, you know, a whole statutory regime of rules regarding compensation committee independence. And in fact, while the CEO may have some input, the actual decisions are made by an independent compensation committee, which consists of no employee or executive member of any company. So in theory, these decisions are independent and the CEO does not have that much input into his pay.
How does this consulting business work? I mean, you know, excuse me, but once you get past, say, $30 million a year, I mean, how do you make an intelligent argument about, no, actually he needs $100 million or she needs $150 million? I mean, I just don't – once you get past a certain level of money, it just seems – like you're talking in the complete abstract.
Well, you know, a lot of it, we start, the square one is you start with a peer group. You look at what other companies are paying. And there are certainly certain instances where some executives are paid more than others in order to attract or retain a certain candidate or incumbent. Where a lot of the money does come from, though, is not actual, you know, salary and cash being paid on an annual basis. It's the, you know, the stock options or the restricted stock that was issued earlier on, perhaps in a career, and is now paying off. But if it's paying off on behalf of the CEO in terms of stock price appreciation, it should be similarly benefiting all of the shareholders of that corporation.
And it's certainly the case that there are a lot of corporate heads who have gotten paid enormous amounts of money that doesn't necessarily track with the performance of the stock or the performance with the revenues and profits.
That is the case. But I think the intent of compensation committees is to have a parallel. You know, we call it pay for performance in the business. And in fact, we have to disclose how pay and performance align in proxy statements. So companies are getting better and better at trying to make sure that shareholders really benefit in parity with the CEOs.
You mentioned the peer group being a determinant of how much people get paid. Is this a market-based number here? I mean, why is there any need to pay anyone $100 million to perform in a company?
Again, you have to attract and retain and motivate talent. You know, the executive team at a very large company needs to be motivated to stay and perform. And again, a lot of that
The $20 million isn't going to motivate. $100
well,
million is the only thing.
A lot of that $100 million or $20 million that you see that's reported is not actual pay at the outset. It's pay based on performance. So if the company has achieved and they've grown in terms of their financial components or their stock price, that's what goes into that. So in theory, shareholders are benefiting at the same, you know, in parity with the CEO's investment in the company.
And of course, that is the theory, and I think, you know, we're doing reasonably well right now on Wall Street. But the debate over income inequality in the United States is never really going to get started. There's not going to be a radical reorganization of executive pay in America because we're committed to this idea that the peer group kind of rules.
I think that's right. And I think this whole concept that disclosure of a pay ratio is going to dramatically impact the way CEOs are paid, you know, may be a little off. I don't think that it's going to result in income equality. What it will result in, really, the unintended consequences is the impact it has on the employee population, who will now see, you know, Joe employee is paid 1 to 500 or some ratio that was always out there, but now your employee base is going to see that, and it's going to be a whole communication process to explain how we got this employee, who we excluded, why, you know, it may look off compared to other companies because maybe we have a large overseas population or a large part-time population, which is included in the calculation.
Have you ever advised a compensation package significantly downward in your consulting?
There are circumstances, again, with a focus on pay for performance. If a company is not performing and shareholders are not benefiting, we certainly look at those options.
Without mentioning names and without hopefully putting you on the spot too much, aren't there instances where corporate executive pay is just obscenely out of scale?
I think where people really find that is on, you know, the so-called golden handshake or the packages for outgoing executives, where you have a severance package set up that's really pay for failure. And that's where the extremes are, and that's where the public outrage is.
Do you believe anything needs to be changed about the current system? Are you satisfied with the way it is right now, that the market is delivering a verdict on executive pay, or should there be some sort of realignment here coming forward?
Well, it's kind of funny. What I believe is irrelevant. It's what the public perceives. And I think, as you mentioned earlier, in times of economic distress, everybody gets very excited about executive compensation and blames the top five executives. Who are the executives who have compensation disclosed? What they don't look at, or, you know, what we don't have access to, are all the other highly paid investment bankers and, you know, people doing these mortgage deals. We don't know their compensation. It's not required to be disclosed. However, if you flip, you know, you flip it and you look at times of, you know, high stock market prices and investors thriving, we don't focus on executive compensation too much.
Deborah Lipshey is managing director in the New York office of Pearl Myers and Partners. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Quick something to take with you today for the weekend. Time began in 1912, the birth year of North Korea's first leader, Kim Il-sung. So in this year, 104, North Korea is going to adjust the last vestige of its enslavement by the Japanese during World War II. Pyongyang will create its own time zone, Pyongyang time, setting its clocks 30 minutes behind those of South Korea and Japan. The change is set to go in effect on August 15th, the 70th anniversary of Japan's defeat in World War II. When you control the clocks and the calendar, now, that's real power. That's all for today. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.